Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. It can be really challenging to get the timing of your love life right. How do you find the right person at the right time? Well, for Elizabeth Koster, there was something else adding to that pressure, her mother's cancer. Elizabeth writes about that in her essay, Agreeing to Accept and Move On. It's read by Sarah Goldberg, who stars opposite Bill Hader in Barry on HBO.
After my mother was told she had incurable cancer, she became obsessed with finding me a husband. One afternoon from her office, between negotiations for a client's book contract, she called three times to tell me about a man my father had met who worked in a Soho lamp store. My mother, a powerful publisher and literary agent who had championed Stephen King, now wanted to set me up with someone who sold lamps. "He's leaving for France soon," she said. "Call him." Although irritated, I went home to put on my tight jeans and spaghetti strap shirt and walked over to the store, where a handsome man talked about his coming trip to France without asking me a single question. During my mother's next frantic phone call, she said to look at two celebrity brothers' web pages and choose the one I liked so she could forward my photo. I cringed, but thought, hey, you never know. "You're not smiling here," my mother said about one photo. "Your forehead is oily in this one. These don't highlight what you really look like." In response to the fifth, she finally wrote, "Yes, this is the best. No one sees themselves properly. I've noticed this time and again, especially with myself, but with others very consistently." When my photo got no response, she shrugged and said, "I tried." Doctor said she had up to 10 years. She was 66. I was 28. Thinking I would be alone to face her illness, I searched for men in stores and coffee shops, bars and parties, on subway platforms and at bus stops, and on OkCupid, FastCupid, and Match.com. On top of my full-time teaching job, I took a part-time position at Eastern Mountain Sports so I could find an outdoorsy man. "Now you're thinking," my mother said. I didn't meet anyone and quit after 3 weeks. "It only takes one," she said, and recounted how she had met my father. At 37, then vice president of a publishing company, she'd gone on a bus tour of Tiffany Glass in the hope of finding someone. When she boarded the bus, she smiled at an attractive man before sitting in front of him. During the tour's lunch break, he asked, "Would you like to join me? I know a good pizza parlor." My mother liked his boyish good looks, blonde hair, and hazel eyes. A week later, they went on a double date at the bar atop the World Trade Center. My mother pointed out waiters to me in restaurants. "Do you think he's cute?" Got me the phone number of a man she met at a party, and even, without telling me, included the following pitch at the end of her 50th anniversary high school alumni update. "Our exceptional and beautiful daughter is a high school English teacher who loves teaching. She's almost 29, is single, and if anyone has a son who's wonderful and single and looking, please contact me. I know this shows how shameless I am, but who knows? After all, I met my husband on a bus." No one contacted her. At a friend's wedding, I met Matt, a tall redhead from Colorado. We danced, his lead confident, and he answered everything correctly on my invisible checklist. Avid reader, Democrat, liked outdoor activities and travel. We spent that night and the following day together before he flew home. For weeks, we traveled back and forth to see each other, giddy with possibility. "Do you think this relationship is promising?" my mother asked. "I do," I said, happy to please. I sent photos of our skiing adventures, and she wrote, "Gorgeous, thanks so much, sweetheart." Then she forwarded them to her therapist and her friend with the note, "I'm so happy." Things got serious enough that Matt planned a job transfer to New York. I focused my attention on him as my mother started an alternative treatment that had been successful in patient trials and that she was convinced would extend her life past 10 years. By the time her treatment started, Matt had moved into his Brooklyn apartment. The number of tumor cells in my mother's body decreased, and she continued to work in her home office as usual. Matt and I cooked and hiked and danced together, and I thought I was set. One day, my mother called to see if I wanted to bring him over for dinner. "So," she asked, "is this it?" I feigned annoyance, though I secretly liked the bond my mother and I now had. "Mom, I've only been with Matt for 2 months." "Okay, okay," I could see her raising her hands in supplication. When we arrived for dinner, flowers were everywhere. The chicken had a wine reduction sauce that she had spent hours simmering. She blushed and stammered around Matt, who listened intently and shared engineering stories with my father. The next day, she called to exclaim, "We love him!" Weeks later, she complained of pain and her stomach swelled. On a visit to her office, I was surprised to see a pushed-aside plate of uneaten crackers. She'd always had such an appetite. When I shared my fears with Matt, he just looked at me helplessly, arms dangling. Then he cooked a meal and we ate in silence. It seemed we couldn't talk about what mattered. "You want me to be your rock?" he asked, confused. He said he would try. But after I visited my mother in the hospital, when her sodium levels were so low that she was jumbling her words, he still didn't know what to say. After my mother had recovered from her lapse, she asked if she should get my grandmother's engagement ring from the safe deposit box. I stalled and said it had only been 3 months. "So, Seinfeld married his wife after 3 months." Whether that was true or not, she saw the ring as a talisman from harm, a symbol that I was taking care of. It was platinum with a small square diamond, and I held it up to the light and admired it on my hand. "It's too big," I told my mother. "It's easy to get it altered." I told her I was unsure about him. "Nobody's perfect," she said. I took online quizzes to determine if I was attracted to Matt. According to some, I wasn't. But we had the same interests, and we'd had so much fun before, and he said he loved me. One afternoon at my parents' apartment, I told my mother about my reservations. "Is there still a spark between you two?" she asked. I shook my head. "I see. Without a spark, it won't work." She reminisced that she had always thought my father was so handsome. Always. I could start to let him go, once she had. It took weeks before I told Matt that it just wasn't working. He asked if we could keep trying, but I knew I couldn't. After we broke up, I saw how thin my mother had become, how her clothes hung. She was lucid at work, but in the apartment she sometimes forgot how to get up from a chair. My father and I took turns helping her, hooking her armpits as she pushed down with her hands and rocked forward. One day she told me I was the most important thing that had ever happened to her, besides my father. Her eyes closed as she said, "When I was born, she felt like she was in love." Seeing an opening, I told her that it was difficult to see her dying. "I'm not dying. I'm fighting," she said as her eyes snapped open. "I've always been fighting." Missing the connection we had shared over my relationship with Matt, I went to lunch with him now and then, hoping something would change between us. "I saw him today," I would tell her. "And?" Still nothing. From her bed one evening, as the light caught the curve of her collarbone, my mother told me, "You know, maybe you don't want to get married. Maybe you want to be single for the rest of your life. That's okay." Stunned by her words, I didn't recognize this woman before me. "And maybe," she continued, "you don't want children. They can be a real pain." I stifled a laugh. "I definitely want children," I said. Then I looked at her curiously, wondering where all this was coming from. This from the woman who had tried so hard to marry me off. She would be dead in a month. She would never see me married or meet my kids. And she knew that then. It was her way of letting go.
That's Sarah Goldberg reading Elizabeth Koster's essay, Agreeing to Accept and Move On. We'll catch up with Elizabeth right after this.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Elizabeth Koster was 31 when her mother died, and she says after losing her mother, she became obsessed with writing about their relationship and how her mother's illness shaped her own life.
My mom had breast cancer starting from when I was a baby. I think I was 6 months old, and she kept having recurrences. She had stage 4 cancer when I was 4 years old, and she fought it, but she was told that it would come back. And so she knew she was a ticking time bomb. Cancer was everywhere, and I thought I could lose her any day. So there was a lot of pressure to meet someone from a very young age. I think I was 5 when my mom showed me a Barbie doll with an engagement ring, and she said, "She has a ring, so she's getting married." And she said this with such awe that I felt like, oh, I have to find somebody too.
And that pressure to find someone didn't go away when her mother died.
I wanted security. I wanted family. I wanted the comfort that I thought would be guaranteed from a relationship. So I made dating a full-time job for years. I went on 3-4 dates a week. Sometimes I'd have 2 dates in one night. And I once had 4 dates in one day. And I wasn't really as discerning as I am now. I didn't really trust myself. And so I just spent so much time meeting these people who mainly ended up not being right for me.
And there was even more pressure because Elizabeth wants kids, and her desire to have children was tied to her own fear of getting cancer.
One thing that I heard in my 20s was that not having a child before the age of 35 can increase the chances of getting breast cancer. So it became a life or death situation for me to find someone and have a child before the age of 35, or else I could die. But as it turns out, I ended up getting breast cancer when I was 33 2 years before my deadline. It was a very early stage. I was treated. I was told it wasn't genetic, and I'm fine now, but it was really scary at the time.
Elizabeth says that after her treatment, some of the pressure around dating eased. She started focusing more on the things she loved, writing, being outside, her friends, and her thinking about children has changed too.
And in the past couple of years, people have been saying, just have one on your own. And I really didn't want that because I've just had this fantasy since I was a kid, probably, that I would meet somebody, fall in love, and create a child out of that love. And that hasn't happened. And I just got so tired of pounding the pavement and not finding anyone. So I very recently, probably within the past year, came around to the idea of having a kid on my own.
Elizabeth does miss her mother, who she says was her cheerleader.
I remember soon after she died, I was on a vacation with some friends, and I kept having the impulse to call her and tell her what we had seen and done that day. And it took a long time to understand that I could never call her again, which sounds strange, but it's muscle memory. It's nearly impossible for the mind to grasp that someone who was there for so many years is just gone.
That's Elizabeth Koster. She's a writer and creative writing teacher living in New York City. She's currently finishing a memoir. More after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
I find these pieces so interesting where someone's sick, facing death, and on the way there, either out of a sense of distraction or out of a sense of obligation or out of love or caretaking, they involve themselves in someone else's love life. And on the one hand, that's so touching, and it's such a loving act, and it's a time of camaraderie between the two of them when things could otherwise just be sort of sad and in a state of decline. It's something they can rally around. But on the other hand, that need of the mothers, I thought it was so interesting how much pressure that puts on a relationship, and how the daughter, she's like, I wanted it to work. I wanted to love him because here's my mother sort of clinging to this hope and having that hope be a sort of reviving force in her life. And if I can't give her that hope, then I'm contributing to her decline in a way. It seems like that's what Elizabeth was taking on.
And here's Sarah Goldberg on why she liked this piece.
She writes with such precision and economy about these big, big topics like death and time and love. And it was so moving. I felt this sort of idea of the expectations that we put on the people we love and the expectations that we then put on ourselves for the people we love. And that ultimately we have to let go of all of these expectations in order to truly connect and show our real love. So I just thought it was kind of a succinct, beautiful story about that and beautifully, beautifully written.
Thanks again to Sarah Goldberg. You can see her starring as Sally Reed in HBO's Barry. Next week, Lake Bell.
No one goes into a move expecting to fall for her mover. I was no exception. This was back in October 2001, when people advertised their services by taping flyers to lampposts among signs for the 9/11 missing. That's where I found Derek's number, which I called in secret while my boyfriend was getting sloshed at whatever Brooklyn dive sold the cheapest drinks. We were being evicted from our apartment, a third floor walk up over a check cashing store. My boyfriend, normally a sad drunk, had trashed the place. Our landlord was wise to sever ties with him. I was too insecure to do the same. I decided to move in with a girlfriend. I told Derek all this during our first phone call. To his enduring credit, the mover didn't find this strange.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Samantha Hennig, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at The New York Times. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.